I would encourage you then, if you would, to open your Bible again to Ruth chapter 3. Ruth chapter 3, and we have spent a couple of weeks already in this chapter. As you'll notice, we did three sermons in chapter 2, and now again three sermons in chapter 3, all having the same title, of course, but just part 1, 2, and 3. And I want you to note again that we're going back to that theme that I was talking about the last couple of weeks, this strangeness that appears in this text, the strangeness that in this chapter as we read it. Remember, we started off looking at the beginning of the chapter of Naomi's request, and even as we looked further in the text, we saw that it was more of a command to Ruth to go. We thought that was rather strange because it seemed rather pushy, seemed rather aggressive on her part. As we're reading that through 21st century AD ears, it seems a little aggressive to us. And then we looked at Ruth going to the threshing floor in verses 6 to 9. We saw that as rather obscure, rather different, if you will. Remember the whole phrase, spread your wings over me, and we had to deal with the obscurity of that phrase and the strangeness of it. There's another strangeness as we come to the end of the chapter. The whole chapter is strange, but each individual part is strange in itself. There is a strangeness in Boaz's response that is often overlooked in reading the story. I've used that same line three times now. There's a strangeness in looking at Naomi's request. There's a strangeness in looking at Ruth's, what she did. And now there's a strangeness in Boaz's response as we just read the story, as we just go through it, especially when we read it through the lens of our presuppositions. Now, let me just pause there for a moment and explain what I mean by that. When I use this term strangeness, I mean this. We have a tendency to read the Bible, and particularly the Bible, through our presuppositions, and they guide how we see, quote-unquote, the text. We read the Bible through a set of presuppositions that we have accumulated over a period of time through both experience and learning and training. We've had these presuppositions upon us, and we have a tendency to read the text and overlook what it actually says in favor of what our presuppositions say it says. I'll never forget when I first discovered this reality. We were sitting at Bethlehem Baptist Church, downtown Minneapolis. Occasionally we would go down, when we were living in Minneapolis, we would occasionally go down to Bethlehem Baptist and sit under John Piper's preaching there. And I remember one day sitting there as he's preaching through some passages. I don't even remember what it was, to be honest with you. But this thought came to me. How in the world did he bring that out of the text? There it is right in front of me, and it's so obvious, and yet I never saw it. And the answer to that is because we come to the text with a set of presuppositions that, in an essence, blinds us to what it actually says, to what the words on the page actually say. We take these presuppositions and we layer them upon ourselves, and therefore we read things in a way that is contradictory very often to what the text actually says. I can't tell you the number of times that people have said, that's not what this says. Yeah, that's what it says. It's right there on the page. It's right there on the paper. There's the word right there. Probably the best example of this is right here in this particular book. How many of us, unfortunately, have a tendency to read this book as some sort of romantic novel? To read this as a great love story, right? Between a young foreign girl and a kind, rich stranger who meet and fall in love and marry. As though that's the point of the book. Again, notice what we're doing. We're reading that through a set of presuppositions. But I hope I've dispelled that notion, and I'm going to do even more to damage it this morning as we look at this book. So once again, we're going to walk through the story, and we're going to glean its details, and we're going to look for relevant theological topics and their application to us today. So let's go to verse 10 and begin reading there. And he said, that is, and Boaz said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he's not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until morning. That is his response, then, to what she has requested, or at least the beginning of his response. He says first, may you be blessed by the Lord. Okay, first words out of his mouth as he responds to what she said. And this, you remember, echoes his own words to her back in chapter 2. If you look back at chapter 2, verse 12, you remember he says to her, may the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel. May you be blessed by the Lord. In other words, that the Lord would indeed bless you. And I'm going to go so far as to say, may the Lord even bless you through me. Okay? Because as I hypothesized last week, he was inviting her to come to him and accept his generosity as the means through which God could bless her. He was inviting her into such a place. So now Boaz indicates that he intends to fulfill the request. Now, that's by implication here, okay? You have to read the rest of it, but you can't get too far down the page before you realize that's exactly what he's doing, okay? So here, by implication, he is intending to say that he is going to fulfill the request that God would bless her, and he will be the means by which this will occur. But you will notice that he adds a qualifier. And this is one of those places where we have to look at the strangeness of the text. A qualifier to the statement which reveals much about his intentions, which, by the way, he says twice in this passage, once here and also again in verse 11. Why does Boaz refer to Ruth as his daughter? See it? He refers to her as his daughter. Now, as I said, here's where the strangeness begins. You don't typically marry your daughter. At least you're not supposed to. So what is Boaz actually alluding to here? Okay. Now, again, let me just step back for a moment. If we read this as a romantic novel, what do we have to do? We have to superimpose upon this word some implications of it that we don't want to be a part of the novel. So we have to read over this word. And I don't want you to do that. I want you to exegete the word into the phrase. Boaz intends to take the role of a father figure to her. Now, you notice I specifically use the term father figure. Okay, because I'm not going to say he's going to be her father. She had a father, but he's going to become a father figure to her in answering her request. Rewind back to the beginning of this book. You remember when Naomi decided to come back to Israel, when she decided that there was nothing left for her in Moab, she tried unsuccessfully to send Ruth back to her parents' house. Remember? Go back to your mother's house. Remember? Go back, chapter 1, verse 8. Go back to your mother's house. There's nothing for you with me. There's nothing for you in Israel. So you girls, remember she was talking to both Orpah and Ruth, go back to your mother's house and find rest there. That's a key word, by the way. I'll have you remember. Rest. Remember that sense of security, that sense of support that comes from a woman having a husband in that particular day. Go back to your mother's house in order to find rest. Go back and find the security, the protection, and provision of a husband. In fact, even Naomi herself said at the very beginning of this chapter, is it not my responsibility to seek rest for you? Okay, now that you followed me to this place. The duty of a parent was to raise a daughter and then find her a husband. That was the duty of a father. A father raised the daughter until the daughter reached the age where she could marry, and then he would find her a husband and set her on a path of security and protection and prosperity with her husband. And so Boaz is stepping up as a father figure to serve Ruth in providing her with a husband, as a father would. That's why he calls her my daughter. I want to take the role of what a father would take of finding you a husband. Now, true, he will become that husband. And I think he even desires to do so. Okay? But he is approaching this duty more as a father figure than as a romantic partner. When we read this story as a romantic novel, we think of him in this case coming to her and saying, I want to be your husband. I've fallen in love with you. I want to have children with you and so forth. But that's not the picture that's really being painted here. The picture is a man who is stepping up and saying, I'm going to step into the role of a father who is going to come and provide for you what you need. And I think the next statement that he makes proves the point. Because he says, you have made this last kindness greater than the first. Now, there's two possible interpretations of that phrase. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you've not gone after young men, whether rich or poor. One possible interpretation is that Boaz is flattered that Ruth would come to him for marriage. One possibility is that he's saying to her, oh, I'm so glad you came to me. I didn't expect that you would come to me. I mean, after all, I'm a little bit older than the other guys out there. And, I'm not the first choice, you know. I'm probably not the most handsome guy in town. Yes, I've got a little money, but, you know, most times young women don't marry for money first. They marry for love. My wife did. She married for love, not for money. She promised me she'd marry the next time for money. But the fact is that it could be this picture of Boaz standing there and feeling flattered about the fact that that she would seek him as a husband, that you came to me. Now, I'm not suggesting that's impossible. It's certainly a possibility. He could be feeling a sense of flattery that this young girl would come to him. But there's a better interpretation of that phrase, in my opinion. That Boaz sees Ruth's request in a different way. When he says, you have made this last kindness greater than the first, the natural question we have to ask is, okay, what's the first kindness, right? What's the first kindness that he's referring to? Now, again, I would suggest that it's a reference back to his own words, as much of what he has said is a reference back to his own words. Going back to chapter 2 and verse 11, he said, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and your mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. That is the reason, by the way, he then says in verse 12, the Lord repay you. Why? Because you showed tremendous kindness to your mother-in-law, a kindness that allowed you to actually leave your family and your native land to come to a foreign place, a place that nobody, that you knew nothing about, to follow her. That is the kindness that Boaz is referring to. The first kindness was her kindness to her mother-in-law, willing to leave everything familiar and follow her. Which means then that the last kindness is a reference to Ruth taking care of Naomi in this request. You have made the last kindness greater than the first. Your first kindness was following after your mother-in-law so that you could take care of her. And everything you have done up to this point has been about her, about taking care of Naomi. And so you've made this last kindness, which is this request, greater than the first. In other words, it's not a kindness to Boaz at all. It's a kindness to Naomi. It's not a kindness to Boaz. He doesn't say that, does he? Again, notice, if we just read this quickly, we just assume he's talking about, you've been kind to me. No. Boaz is saying, Ruth, your request is actually a kindness to your mother-in-law. Again. So what this phrase is really saying is this. Ruth, in your request, I see that you're not just going after what you need. See, because Ruth could have just come to Israel, followed her mother-in-law to this place, or even stayed at home and done this, and just said, you know what, Naomi's on her own, I've done what I can, so I'm going to leave her to herself. So I'm going to go and find me the rest that I need, right? There's a whole group of young men over here that are of marrying age, you know, here in Bethlehem. They're all just waiting for a bride. And so I could go to any of them, you know, and seek out a husband, and then I would have my security. I'd be able to have a home and probably a family after that. And so I could seek my own rest. And by the way, all of those men over there, some are rich and some are poor. That, by the way, the phrase at the end of the sentence is what clues me in to what the sentence means. You could have chased down other men. Some could be rich, some could be poor. But you didn't. You put Naomi's interests in all matters above your own. Your request that you're asking me right here in this, in the darkness here on the threshing floor, what you're asking me is something to put Naomi's interest above your own. She has unselfishly sought a way for Naomi to be taken care of. Through her. She'll be the instrument, but it's through her that Naomi is being taken care of. And Boaz recognizes this unselfishness. Thus, he wishes to be the instrument through which Ruth can bring such rest to her mother-in-law. You see, when Boaz hears this request, he doesn't hear it as, oh, you've come looking for a romantic partner. You've come looking for a marriage partner. No, no, no. He hears it as a request for the benevolence of a man towards Naomi. You have made this last kindness greater than the first. This is a greater act of kindness, Boaz says, than your even leaving Moab to follow Naomi here. So this is why I say this phrase convinces me of what he said previously is simply his way of saying, yes, I will be the father figure. I will be the father figure that will step in and help you to achieve that goal. To achieve a way for your mother-in-law to be taken care of. And so he says, do not fear. Notice he repeats it. My daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Again, read the phrase carefully and notice the word worthy. Remember that word? Remember where we saw it last? Remember the big deal I made about that word back at the beginning of chapter 2? When the narrator of this story, the author, puts that word to Boaz? Remember the first verse of chapter 2? Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. The writer inserted that as a bit of information about who this man is. And now Boaz takes that exact same word and applies it to Ruth. You are a worthy woman. Now, you remember at the time we said that this could mean one of two things. It could be a person who had wealth or position in society. Well, that certainly could apply to Boaz, but I'm sorry, it doesn't apply to Ruth. So that obviously can't be what Boaz means. But the other interpretation was a person of noble character. Boaz was a man of noble character, wasn't he? He's demonstrating it. And so he applies the same word to Ruth. He says, you are a woman of worthy, noble character. And by the way, everybody in the village knows it. Everybody in the village knows it. I mean, does that not echo what he himself said in verse 11 of chapter 2? All that you have done for your mother-in-law has been told to me. By whom? The people in the village. Those in the town who knew this Naomi and who knew this Ruth by virtue of Naomi. Everybody knows what kind of woman she is. And so Boaz says, I pledge to take on the role of father figure in order to be the means through which Ruth, your selfless provision for Naomi, is realized. I see you as worthy of being my daughter, the kind of woman that I can take and take care of, that I can make sure that there is someone who follows who gives you the security, the prosperity, the rest, that word that's used a number of times in this book, the rest that you need in order for your mother-in-law to be taken care of. Her reputation makes this important to do. Her reputation makes this important to do. She comes to Boaz, makes a request, and what Boaz sees is a worthy woman who he's willing to step into the role of father figure. Now let me just pause here for a moment, if I might be so bold. Just pause here for a moment, just put your pen down for a second, and consider this. Why do people come to Jesus? How do they perceive Jesus such that they wish to be connected to him somehow? Why? You know, there's a sad reality in Western civilization today that there's a romanticized version of Jesus that permeates much of Christianity today. A romanticized version of Jesus. And what I mean by a romanticized version of Jesus, notice I'm specifically using the word romanticized because I want to connect it to the thought we're having here. A romanticized version of Jesus is a perception of Jesus as one who loves us in that very modern emotional connection sort of way, right? That whole, I want to be loved. I want to feel this love. I want to experience this emotional sense of well-being. That Jesus is the one we come to because he wants to take care of us. We come to him because he wants to primarily love us so that we can go out then and love others. The picture of Jesus is this picture, this romanticized idea that Jesus is just this super pal that you can have who loves you and wants to take care of you and wants your life to be happy and comfortable and therapeutic. Jesus is what some writers call him. It's a perception of Jesus that ignores the real Jesus found in the Gospels. The Jesus who infuriates the religious leadership frequently. The Jesus that drives people away who come to him when they come for the wrong reasons. The Jesus that demands absolute self-sacrifice in order to be his disciple. The Jesus that focuses his entire earthly ministry upon a cross, a bloody instrument of death. And who rebukes his own disciples when they try to turn him from that goal. They ignore those things about Jesus. The romanticized version of Jesus is the one that looks at Jesus and goes, oh, isn't he such a friend to sinners and just a lover of my soul? See, I believe that we must drop this romanticized notion of Jesus if we're going to come to him properly. We must come to the biblical Jesus. Let's drop this romanticized notion of why we come to him. We must come to him on his terms and for what he offers. Not what we think we want from him, but what he actually offers to us. In other words, our presuppositions of Jesus must not cause us to lose the real reason we come to him. We come to him as the Savior of our souls, not just the lover of our lives. I think there's so many today who have lost this. I know people specifically who speak this way, who see Jesus as someone who loves my life and loves me and just loves everything about my existence and wants me to be happy and wants me to go out and make other people happy too. But there's no discussion of sin. There's no discussion of God's wrath. There's no discussion of the reality that the real problem that human beings have is not their happiness, but their holiness. That the real problem that they have is that they spend their lives in rebellion against this God, claiming at the same time to love him. That's a romanticized version of Jesus. Very much like reading the book of Ruth as a romantic novel. It's like reading the Gospels as a romantic novel, as though Jesus is simply the lover of our lives. In other words, we must come to Jesus that he might be our Redeemer. That he might be our Redeemer, that he might be the one to rescue us from our primary problem. And what is our primary problem? Our primary problem is what all of us are facing. Death. Death is our primary problem. It is coming to this world by sin. And we stand in a place of judgment and another death if we are not ready for this Jesus, if we do not come to this Jesus as our Redeemer. Yes, it is good that Jesus loves us, but it is all important that Jesus saves us from the wrath of God. I put that there because I really want you to notice that when Boaz sees and hears the request of Ruth, he doesn't see it through this romanticized lens of, oh, somebody loves me and wants to have children with me. He sees it for what it really is, a picture of a woman who is pursuing after the best for someone else, her mother-in-law, a selfless act of coming to him and asking for him to be her Redeemer. And he responds, not in a romantic way, but in a way that's consistent with his character of being worthy. Yes, I will be your Redeemer, but I'm going to be your father figure to lead you to what you really need. Which leads us then to what he says next, which helps bolster my point. All right, he says, there is a Redeemer nearer than I. There is another relative in the family that has a higher position in the legalities of the Levirate marriage structure, okay? So he reveals to her, yes, I am a Redeemer, but there's somebody who is closer. There's someone who can be a Redeemer before me. Now, let's note something here. We're unsure of a couple of things here. We're unsure of what relation Boaz is to Elimelech. We don't really know, do we? We don't really know. We're not told anywhere how Elimelech is related, where he fits into the family tree. And secondly, what we also don't know is what the rules were regarding the transmission of responsibility within the family. Even the passage that I spoke about the Sadducees coming to Jesus and talking, they don't, in that passage, even give a hint as to which brother has to marry her first and then in the next and so on, and what happens when all the brothers are dead, then which uncle and then which cousin. And so there's no mention of that, and there's nothing even in the Levitical law as it's laid out. So we don't know what the customs were in that day as to how it works. All we know, according to Boaz, is that there's somebody in that structure that's in a higher position than him. And what we also know, according to chapter 4, verse 7, is that there are a number of customs that are unknown in this process as well. So we're left with a whole lot of questions as to this, but we'll just take Boaz's word for it, that there is somebody out there who is in a higher position, a better position to actually accomplish this. So Boaz knows this structure and admits before Ruth that he is not the first choice legally. Okay? There's someone else. And so he makes the statement, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. In other words, if this other relative wishes to do this, I will surrender. Now, I'm convinced, absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I'm easily convinced by the stupidest things, this goes to show that Boaz is acting as a father figure. His concern is much more for Ruth's need over his own. I mean, come on. If Boaz was in this for love, would he say that? If Boaz was in this for love, as a romanticized version, would he say that? Well, there's this other guy that's more legal, so if he'll do it, good, let him do it. If he was chasing after this girl because he was in love with this girl, because he was chasing after her as a potential wife in that romanticized novel version, I don't see that phrase in the story. That doesn't fit on the Hallmark Channel version of the Book of Ruth, right? If he is not if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. Okay? So as a father figure, I'm going to step up, Ruth, and I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to find the man who can serve the role of bringing the security that your mother-in-law needs through you. And as a father figure, then I'm going to go and find the best man for that. If it's not me, maybe it's this other guy. Now, he does say, if he's not willing, I will redeem him. He makes a pledge to do this if called upon to do so. Okay? But he recognizes that there's somebody in a better position than him. In other words, Boaz's pledge here recognizes a barrier that stands in the way. He recognizes a barrier. He is not in the best position legally to take this on. There's somebody else. But he's willing to put himself under that, to do whatever it takes to accomplish the redemption of Ruth, even if that means getting out of the way himself. Even if that means it isn't about me. But that's what a father would do. That's what a father figure would do. A father figure would say, what I want is the best for my daughter. I'm not settling. I want to do this the way that it should be done. So he reveals an issue. Okay, so far we have seen two parts to this response of Boaz. Okay, first, he responds directly to her request, and he responds specifically in terms of her character and saying what he wants to say to her as committing himself to be a father figure. And then secondly, he reveals now an issue. Okay? But there is a third response. There is a third response, and it starts in verse 14. It actually starts at the very end of 13 when he says, lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. I mean, rose before dawn. All right. And he said, this is Ruth speaking, Boaz speaking, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, that is Ruth, Naomi said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then Ruth told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, quote, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law, unquote. Naomi replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest but settle the matter today. There's another response here. The first response is, I recognize your request, and I'm going to step in to be a father figure. The second is, there's a potential barrier or problem in the way, but there's a third. He says, lie down until morning. He says, do not rush off in the dark. Okay? Stay here until it's safe to go home. Now, let me just make it clear that I don't believe there's any inappropriate activity implied here. In fact, I think that him saying, lie down at my feet, may be Boaz's way of showing his sincerity by demonstrating purely gentleman behavior towards her for the rest of the night. Lie down here at my feet, and I will protect you until the morning comes. Or it could be a metaphor for rest in me. A simple phrase, lie down. Rest in me. But then he says to this, he says, let it but not be known that the woman came. Now, this is a difficult, strangely written sentence in English. Because when you read it in English, it's though Boaz is speaking to someone else, right? Let it not be known that the woman came. Okay. I think that this is, in fact, a caution to Ruth to protect her reputation. I think it's highly likely that Boaz says this directly to her. There's no hint in the text anywhere that he would have said this to someone else, for the very simple reason that he himself is trying to say in the text itself, or in the phrase, don't let anybody know that you have come. So he wouldn't have said this to somebody else. Okay. Ruth coming to the threshing floor, especially at night, could be perceived by others as inappropriate. Even I pointed that out just a moment ago. And given that the village recognizes her as a worthy woman, this visit could ruin that reputation if people find out about it. So I think it's just a difficult phrase to translate from Hebrew into English. And so a literal translation like the ESV attempts to do simply turns this into something that looks a little awkward English-wise. But I think it's Boaz simply saying to Ruth, don't tell anyone that you came here. We'll deal with this just privately amongst ourselves. Okay? But the more important fact is that he gives to Ruth 6 measures of barley. Why? Why? Now, again, my tact, you will notice, is to find 2 different possibilities. Let me give you the first. It's possible that Boaz gives Ruth this grain as simply another kindness. Okay, he's been kind to her all along, right? He allowed her to glean in the field. He allowed her to glean in special places so that she could collect even more. So maybe he's just being kind to her again. He knows that she hasn't gleaned much and will still be in need, right? So he's sitting there next to this big pile of grain, and so his natural character is such that he's kind. So he just takes out a 6 measures of it and pours it into her cloak and puts it on her back and says, "Here you go." That's a possibility. And I'm not denying that's possibly true. I do think that there's an element of that. But there's another possibility here. And I think it's a much better possibility. That Boaz gives Ruth this grain as a pledge toward what he had just promised. Very common, by the way, in that particular day and age. He gives this as a pledge to the promise that he has made. Now, you will notice, by the way, that the words of Boaz in verse 17 are not put on the lips of Boaz himself. The narrator doesn't put those words directly on to the lips of Boaz. He makes Ruth recount them back to Naomi. It's what Ruth recounts what he said when he gave her the grain. And he says specifically, verse 17, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. See it? He says, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. I am convinced that the grain is a pledge of promise to Naomi. Not to Ruth, to Naomi. Here, take this grain, bring it back to your mother-in-law, and this is my pledge to Naomi that I will do this thing. I will make sure that you, Ruth, have a husband, which ultimately means that you, Naomi, will be taken care of. Here's my pledge in the form of this grain. And Naomi confirms this, you will notice. She confirms this by instructing Ruth to wait until you learn how the matter turns out. Okay? So in other words, she says to Ruth, stop. Don't go do anything else now. Okay? You've done all that you can, all that you need to do. All right? So let's wait and see how this man does it. Oh, and by the way, based on what he said, he's going to take care of it today. Okay, now that the sun's coming up, he's going to leave the threshing floor, going to go find this other Redeemer guy, and going to take care of it. And of course, as we turn to chapter 4, we know that's exactly what takes place. So she confirms the idea, Naomi does, that she's receiving this grain as a pledge. This man has made a promise to take care of Ruth, thus by extension taking care of her. Now, as we get to the end of chapter 3, have we not discovered that this book's really not about Ruth? How many times have I said, this is a book about Naomi. This is about a book about this woman, this Israelite woman who has lost her husband and her sons and comes back to Israel thinking that she's been abandoned by God, and yet she has this daughter-in-law, this Moabite, this so very unobvious girl who comes with her and becomes the instrument through which this Naomi ultimately is taken care of. Yeah, sure, the book is named after Ruth because Ruth becomes the instrument. But the book is really about how God is taking care of this Naomi. So, let's go back to the thought I had a moment ago about why do people come to this Jesus? Why do people come to this Christ? Let's assume for a moment that people do come to this Christ for the right reason. That they have heard the gospel, they have heard the true gospel, the biblical picture of this Jesus and his message, and they come for the right reason. They come for redemption. How does he respond to us? How does he respond to us? See, the assumption of our romanticized version of Jesus is that Jesus is just waiting to love our lives and help us and these sorts of things. There's no discussion about his response at all. It's just sort of assumed, isn't it? But if we come to Jesus for the right reason, if we come to him for the redemption of our soul, the saving of our soul, how does he respond? How does he, as the ultimate redeemer, parallel Boaz in his response? Now again, as I said a few weeks ago, we have several thousand years of redemptive history through which to read this book. Therefore, we are able to assess the response of Boaz in relation to redemption as it flows out through Christ. So we can step back from this response of Boaz, which we find to be ultimately noble, do we not? And ask the exact same question about this Christ. When we come to him, how does he respond? And let me suggest the three parts of the response of Boaz apply perfectly to the response of Christ. Number one, this Christ that we come to knows the motives of why we come. Make no mistake about it, this Jesus knows exactly why you have come to him, what you are seeking from him. Just as Boaz recognized Ruth's selflessness in coming to him, not for herself, but for her mother-in-law. You see, this Christ knows if we've come to him seeking what he offers rather than what we think he should give us. He knows the difference. He knows why we have come to him. And he also knows if we come to him in humility. Do we come to this Jesus because we finally realized we have no place else to go? Have we come to this Christ because we've come to that place where we said, I have nothing else. I've got no other possibilities. Ruth comes to this Boaz, as I said a few weeks ago, out of a sense of desperation. There is a need. We will die if we don't have someone to take care of us. Christ knows the motives of why we come. He knows why you claim to be a Christian. He knows why you claim to be a Christian. He knows why you've labeled that upon yourself and upon all who call themselves by that. He knows. He knows the hearts of those. So he knows the motives of why we come. Just as Boaz recognized it in Ruth, he saw in her a magnanimous woman, loving her mother-in-law, putting her own needs, putting well under Naomi's, putting Naomi's needs first and her needs way down the list. He saw that in her. He recognized that in her. And then secondly, not only does Christ know the motives of why we come, but it is this Jesus who has overcome all of the barriers that are necessary to redeem us. Just as this Boaz knew that there was another family member in a higher position than himself, yet he promised to help. Now, in the case of Jesus, of course, the parallel breaks a little bit here because there is no one higher than Jesus to redeem us, but he knows the barriers that are necessary to redeem us. And the first great barrier that we must never forget is that this eternal Son of God willingly chose to step down from his Father's side. Willingly chose to robe himself in the limitations of fleshly existence. You and I don't truly appreciate that. We really don't. Because it's beyond our comprehension that the eternal, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent God would become the exact opposite of all those things in flesh. They would robe himself in flesh and be limited to one place at a time, whose glory would be veiled by human flesh. This is a tremendous barrier of having to live in this world as one of us, having to experience people, right? People, other people who don't think like we do. Ever had that experience? course you do. He had more of it than you can imagine. I mean, he had to turn around to his disciples and rebuke them repeatedly for their foolishness and stupidity. James and John poking their mother and sending her to him to say, when you come into your kingdom, I want my firstborn over here and my secondborn over here. Having to endure that. Having to endure living sinlessly under the very law he himself had established. You and I have never had to face the devil down, but he did. He did. And then, of course, in the greatest sense, willingly, voluntarily submitting himself to a wicked instrument of death. Beyond our comprehension, what he experienced on that cross. He knew the barriers of what it would take for himself to step into that position of being the Redeemer. But he also knew another set of barriers, not just the fact that he himself would have to step down from his eternal throne and take on human flesh, but the barrier of fallen men looking only to their religiosity or their morality or their good intentions. Coming to him for all the wrong reasons and with all the wrong motives. All of which blind them to their need to come to him with an empty hand of faith and repentance. The barrier of human beings who look at him and they don't see him as a redeemer, they see him as some sort of a spiritual grandfather that just takes care of all their needs, quote unquote. That's a huge barrier. Massive. If it wasn't, there'd be a whole lot more people worshiping this Jesus, right? This Christ knows why we have come, and he knows what it takes for us to come to him. But then, thirdly, just like Boaz, this Jesus makes a pledge for those he redeems. This Boaz put 6 measures of grain in the cloak of this girl and sent it home to Naomi to say to Naomi, I'm going to do it. You can trust me that I'm going to do it. This Christ makes a pledge as well. And the pledge that he makes to us is that he walks out of a tomb alive on a Sunday morning. That's a pledge. That is a tremendous promise. I'm going to call it 6 measures of hope. 6 measures of hope that secures that those who belong to this Christ will also be raised from the dead. The great need that we have is for someone to overcome that reality. And he has. And he has made a promise. All of those who will come to me with an empty hand of faith, I will raise up on the last day. That's a pledge. And he says, and I can make that pledge to you because I walked out of that tomb. And you can know it's sure because I walked out of that tomb. That's 6 measures of hope. But there's a second part of the pledge. Yes, it's true. It's just a resurrection is part of it, but it's also the pledge of his own spirit. 6 measures of help that secures the elect to this Christ that they will never be lost. He makes a pledge. He says, not only have I risen from the dead to save you, but I've gone to my Father's side and sent to you my own Spirit, who will live in and around and over and under you, so that every aspect of me in you will cover every instance of your existence. That's my pledge to you. I pledge to hold you fast to me to the end. You will not escape. Or better, you will not fall away. The pledge of the Spirit of God. See how Christ responds to us? How does this Jesus respond when we come to him? He knows what our motives are. He knows why we come. We must not come to this Jesus saying, oh, help me to love me more, just love me more, and let me love my neighbor more. No, we come to this Jesus face down with an empty hand of faith, and he knows why, and he knows what it takes to make redemption for us, and he has made a pledge to us. And by the way, if you haven't figured it out yet, that's why this book is such a shadow, foreshadowing of the redemption of this Christ. It is not a romantic novel written about two people who fall in love. It's about the picture of a redeemer. A redeemer. Which reminds me of what Jesus himself says. Remember that word, rest? Remember that word? Remember how often it's used and how often we've used that word? Remember the security, the assurance. Now, we've put it in the context of marriage for Ruth, right? Find rest, go home to your mother's house, find rest there. Or Naomi says, it's not my responsibility to find you rest, so go to this Boaz, he will give you rest. Hey, lie down at my feet, rest in me, see? But Jesus uses that word too, about himself. He says this, he says, all things have been handed over to me by my Father. And no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Meaning that only God knows who God is. Only this Christ knows who this Father is, and no one knows who the Father is without knowing this Jesus. You want to know God? You need to know this Christ. So he makes this invitation. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. What will he give us? Rest. Not some sense of, oh, my life is so wonderful now that I've come to Jesus. Because most of us, if we're really honest, cannot say that. But what we can say is, my assurance, my security, my hope, my pledge is in this Christ. And what he has done as the lover of my soul. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. Jesus actually suggests we're supposed to learn. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. This Ruth comes to Boaz, and she makes this very courageous and bold request. And Boaz responds by seeing in her the worthiness of her request. And he steps into the role of serving as a father figure to her to make sure that what she needs is taken care of, whether that means he gets to marry her or somebody else does. Doesn't matter. All that matters is that the very best is provided for her. And he makes a pledge. Gives to her 6 measures of grain to take back to her mother-in-law and pledges to her, I will take care of this. This, my friends, is exactly what Jesus Christ has done for us. He's done this same thing. He has responded to us when we come to him with the right reasons, the right motives. He has overcome the barriers and he has made a pledge. So when we walk away from Ruth chapter 3, we don't walk away from a romantic novel. Let's erase those presuppositions. We walk away from an assurance that we have one who has done exactly the same for us, this Jesus. Let us rest in him.